Next Chapter Podcasts.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, I'm Michael Goodfriend, and I'm the executive producer of the Play On podcasts. Mfaniso Odofia is a Nigerian-American storyteller, actor, and educator whose work centers on Nigerian immigrant life within the United States. Her play Sojourners, Run Boy Run, Her Portmanteau, and In Old Age have been seen at the American Conservatory Theater, the New York Theater Workshop, Playwrights Realm, Magic Theater, National Black Theater, Strand Theater Company, Boston Court. She's the recipient of the 2017 Helen Merrill Playwright Award and the 2017-18 McKnight National Residency and Commissions at the Playwrights Center, and is a member of the New Dramatist Class of 2023. Fenisso, currently commissioned by ACT, Hartford Stage, Denver Center, ACT Roundhouse, and South Coast Repertory, her plays have been developed by such theaters as the Manhattan Theater Club, the Playwrights Realm, the McCarter, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, many, many others, including Berkeley Rep. And she is the translator of Othello, which is currently the Play On podcast. And she's here with me today. Mfaniso, it's such an honor to have you with us. Thank you for agreeing to be part of the Play On podcast bonus content series for Othello.
Hello, and of course, it's so good to be here today.
I want to start, you and I have had several conversations leading into the process and then throughout. And one of the things that you mentioned, that you sort of posited, if we could call it that, this entire production on, is the question of whose is the body that is dispossessed in this story. Can we start there? What do you mean by dispossessed?
Maybe I actually have to run it back a little even before I talk about dispossessed, to what I thought the play was. I thought the play was a love story, a tragic love story. I think I met that play when I was in 10th grade. Was not a big Shakespeare head, and that's how it was taught to me, and that's the way I received it. So when I was approached, that's what I was like, okay, I'm not a Shakespeare head, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna do this play, Othello, because at least I have some context for it. And in my head was lodged, love story. And then I get in there, and I do. It's not that there's not a kind of love, which we can poke and tap at what love is inside of this, in deep quotation marks for me anyway. But as I was inside the play, the agent, the master mind and villain was Iago. And what he was enacting was a way to dispossess a body that's already othered. And it was in my older age, away from 10th grade English, with some, you know, experience now in the world, where I'm like, oh, I'm looking at a manual of dispossession first for me. And what I mean when I say, now to your question, what is dispossession? It is the way of pushing somebody out onto, marginalizing them, pushing them out onto the outskirts, specifically a body that you don't think belongs within your community, society. And so that's what I mean when I say this for me became a manual to dispossess a human.
In that sense, do you feel that the play still serves a purpose?
That's a great question. That's a great question. The way we educate around this play, I think, needs to become more nuanced. I am not one of those, you know, and I don't know if I will be lambasted for saying this, but I'm not one of those that's like, burn down all of our classics. I think that there is an import to understanding them, but to just look at this play as a love story is a disservice. I think we need to understand what Iago is doing and what might be at the heart of Iago. So I am an advocate for more nuanced education around what it is we're viewing. Because to call it just a love story, a tragic one, without understanding Iago's machinations and from whence that might have come from him, even though specifically race is different across time, century, all of that, without really taking that in, I think we are actually ingesting a malignancy in order to favor a potency on love or like some story of love. And then that, it's not as if we're not ingesting something, you know? So I think more nuanced education needs to happen around Othello or you know, stand inside the reckoning of, we don't know anymore what we're teaching. I mean, that might sound harsh, but for me as a, whatever age I was when I was started translating, I was not happy that all I had inside of me was that this was a tragic love story.
So if you were to teach a class and we're introducing this play to this class, how would you begin now?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I mean, loaded only because I haven't, I don't know if I've like thought it all the way through, but in terms of educating, but one of the components would be, what is a Moor? What were the other peoples? Who were they? The complexity of that word Moor. And an understanding of armies and brotherhood and what it is to be somebody who is other, who's also trying to ascend inside a community and construct that is not your own. And let's get inside that language deeper, not just the poetics of it, but exactly what is Iago saying as he's going through his dispossession arc, and how that animal imagery that he's using is getting uglier and uglier and uglier as this play is going. I would make us actually deal with the words on the page and understand the culture from which this is coming out of, and ask ourselves, like, what are some of the parallels to what we are seeing today? And, you know, and I'm not saying that I'm gonna leave Desdemona and leave that arc of love that is there. I'm just asking us to deal honestly with it. And that, I think, will need a lot more cultural work, context, education, and also drawing parallels to today. So it's not some grand lofty tale that we bow to. It's one that we are picking apart and asking ourselves, actually, what is happening? And what is the blow to the human body? If we're not doing that, if we're only packaging it in one way, then we are doing a disservice, I think, to our population, our children, whoever we are educating.
You mentioned dealing with the words that are there. This is obviously something you did intensely to translate. And so what was that experience for you? what words needed to change and how?
The word more is not a, so, okay, let me actually go a little bit into process too.
Please.
Because I'm not somebody who, I'm not going to tell you like I'm a lover of Shakespeare and I spend all my life reading. I think I've already alluded to I'm not. Mm-hmm. So I read it. And then I sat there with all sorts of books that were helping me parse through what I was reading. And then I said it in my own language, like as I'm funny. So, and one of the rules was do no harm. So as much as possible, keep the iambic pentameter, keep the rhythm, keep the music. Don't move away from the poetry. Just make the poetry more salient for today. And so I couldn't do that step right away. I had to read, have somebody help me understand what I was reading. And then after that, say it in my own way, which means I was destroying rhythm. And then go back and take a look and like, okay, move what I said into something that was verse-like. So I had multiple stages of translation in order to get what you're listening to. Mm-hmm. And that was helpful for me because I'm not versed in this. And so as I was going, I was like, oh, okay, this word more holds so much inside of it. It could be both slur, it could be both, or just a marker of somebody who is different from you. It could be religious. It could connote something that is a religious difference. It just was magnanimous in scope, that one word. And we don't have a word that does that today. So a part of my translating too was going back and going, what do I think is being said? Do I think it is a slur here? Do I think it's just a word to denote the other here? And so that was part of my, I hope I'm answering your question, but that was part of my work was there were these words, anything that becomes racialized today that I had to like figure out, how do I say this? Mm-hmm.
And in the subtitle, in the original, it is The Moor of Venice, mm-hmm. right? And you dispensed with that. That's not in this title.
Mm-mm. I just called it Othello.
Right. And yeah. Can you think of some of the words you used in the translation to replace more?
More might have become beast. If I thought we were in some middle ground terrible, it mm-hmm. might have become ape in order to further stretch some of the animal imagery that might have been happening around it. It might have become black and not necessarily black skinned, because actually I don't know what color Othello was. I just know he's other. But black as a foil to white, which is horribly some thought on what purity is and to what impure is. So depending on the context and out of whose mouth, that word had many other monosyllabic ways that I was using it so that you understood the intent behind the person who was saying that word.
It's so immediate and so incredibly cruel when we hear Iago and how he talks about this person who then in the next instant is kissing up to this person and coddling or what being coddled by whatever, however the nakedness of the cruelty is so evident thanks to the translation. There's no filter.
No. I've been inside of some talkback situations where there has been a, like, why did you do that? It wasn't like that. And I'm like, I actually think it might've been, it was just the way that that word is now so poetic, you don't get to deal in a visceral way with what the intent behind what is being said is. And that was my job, was to make you go, oh, okay. Like maybe when Cassio says that word more, he's going the other. But when Iago's saying that word, he's going the beast.
In your experience working on this, were you able to get to any clarity as to what it is that's driving Iago? Obviously, racism is one. Do you think that's the only thing driving Iago?
I think it's a question on what begets what, which is something I think that we deal with today. Like when you think you are owed, Iago believes he is owed a position, a job. He's been inside the barracks with Othello. And I actually, it's hard to know the histories of them in total to understand if there was ever a time these two were truly braided in true unity, or if there was always something of a, well, I'm a attach and go with him. But what happened is, at least in my estimation, was Othello did not give him a job. It's a tool. His otherness is a tool now that can be used to write the world for what Iago thinks the world should be.
Right.
So I think the inception might have been a jealousy and a deep-seated understanding of what the world should be for someone like him, and the world is not operating that way. And so I'm going to use your otherness in order to rile the world up against you and make you beast in order to get what I think is my due, even if at this point it's just revenge. So that was probably really, really circular, but yes, he's bigoted. Yes, he's racist. And he's also somebody who feels as if he's been slighted. And I think the slighted and the jealousy might come a bit before the othering. It's a dehumanization process in order to get what you want. Now, somebody can push back on that, and I will actually hold that. But that's what I think it's not just race and bigotry. I also think it is the deep-seated jealousy that the world should be mine, not yours.
Right. And that's become the tagline for the whole series, beware of jealousy. It's a famous line from the play itself, of course, but the more we're now into episode three is published today. The more that it we get into this story, the more convinced I am, hearing it over and over again, is just what a driving force that jealousy is.
Yeah.
You know, in addition to, I mean, that the racism is most of it, you know, or at least the booster rocket or some, you know, but it's this envy, this jealousy, this, you know, that somebody that is so devoid of any soul ultimately sees somebody who has such a beautiful soul and wants to destroy it, is even jealous of that,
all of that, because he does not possess it. I mean, it is a tale as old as time. I think it is how, I mean, I'm sorry, America is where America is and what bore America. And it's not just an American thing. If you go into other countries and climates, it's this, you have, I should have it. I am the power paradigm. Thus you are, because I see you as less than me, I'm going to dispossess you, dehumanize you first, to dispossess you, to take what you have. It's pretty baked into the way we humans behave with each other. It's so ugly.
Yeah.
And inside of there is a kernel of a love story, but please don't get it twisted. What's really also happening is we have just pulled this man down, annihilated a whole group of women in order to reset a status quo.
I want to ask a question that's incredibly sensitive. And forgive me if it comes across in any way that's offensive. But you were talking about words to use in place of more, and words that pack that sort of potency today. And you brought up some ape was one, or black. And was it ever in your mind to use the N-word?
I get close. I get close. There's a word I'm not going to say. You will hear it inside the podcast. Mm-hmm. I do get close. I use I believe it's British, a British, almost archaic word for idiot, which holds a root that's going to make any black ear tick. But I also feel like it might be broad enough to hold a wide group of people as opposed to just black bodies that might get that word thrown on them. So I get real close. I didn't go all the way, because that word also holds a very particular American context inside of it. So what I do is I nod to it and widen. There is a word out there, you will hear it, that holds the root of that, and then also widens to hold a whole scope of other people who could be called that. So
so the N-word would be, it's too colloquial to America. I mean, it's too narrow in its scope in that sense.
I just want to make sure that anybody who is othered can be held within this story. Mm-hmm. So when I'm using that animal imagery, part of what I did was take a look and see, oh no, we are using animal imagery all over the world in order to other people who are not like us. Like, it is not just a certain group of people who are called animals. It's a pretty... it's a pretty awful way to go, I'm human, you are not. And we are doing this the old world over. So it feels really salient to hear, but it is important that it can move for me. Colorism moves, which is why white, black moves. Right. Animal imagery moves. The way in which I got close to that word can move.
Right.
So that if you're doing this inside of a country that is not this one, you can still do it and go, ah, okay, that's awful. And it is also true.
There's a difference in the way that the character Othello speaks in your translation. Can you talk a little bit about that and how... before I say anything more, I see you're ready to answer. So go ahead.
Well, I was really interested in what makes a man like him. I was really interested in what makes a man like him. And then there was a way in which in the beginning he speaks with such fluidity. And inside, not my translation, even inside the original, where it's like this whole passage where he's building what his love was, and talking about who he was as a man, and building his history for us, and how who he was a man and his history led him into this moment of love with Desdemona. And it was, for me, it was gorgeous. And it is the place where I break. And anybody who is like inside the Shakespeare and inside mine is like, oh, this is different. I wanted to allow that to breathe. I wanted to give the actor who is playing Othello, whoever that actor might be, who is inside a part that is going to make him by the end of the play rabid, frothing at the mouth and murdering.
Starting. Sorry, continue.
I wanted us to see the living heartbeat of the man and for us to like stand inside of it for a moment, because I cannot in the translation as a translator change what happens in the play. But I can at least crack open the heart as much as I can so that we see that there was a human being, because sometimes it is hard to see that. And especially when I don't have access to the language that Shakespeare is using, it is hard to see that. Sometimes it is hard to feel that. And I was like, by God, I am going to give this, I'm going to try to make him a man. And so, yeah, I gave him ellipses, four eyes. I gave him as much breath as I could before he starts a very quick descent into a jealous turn and re something that looks monstrous.
We talked a lot about that as we were going into production. The sort of the breath and what happens to breath, especially in Iago's case. Can you talk about that?
What happens to breath? Oh, we might have to stop. What happens to breath?
Well, so when we were talking about early on, just sort of the level of containment within Iago, I'm sorry, the level of containment within Othello, this sense of control that he has over himself and the evenness of temperament and
Got
the
it. Okay.
dissolution of that.
I think I heard a th I heard Iago, and I was like, I don't know what I said with Iago on that.
Maybe I said
Before
Iago.
Othello,
Right.
I start allowing a play in line to allow for breathing, and actually in Othello and in Desdemona, I believe, as Iago's pressure cooker starts making their relationship disintegrate, so that you give time for them to feel and get there organically and probably viciously. It is, I wanted to make sure that not only was I translating the word, but I was doing emotional translation as well, giving room and scope. So sometimes, we said it inside the podcast, it is okay for me if a breath is an I am. Take it, feel it. If it happens in the middle, it is fine for me. So that you can give yourself the launch pad that you need to feel to go to descend into this emotional state. So
You were in 10th grade, you said, when you encountered this play for the first time.
I think so. I keep saying that with a surety, but everybody needs to know that I really don't do time very well. I do know I was in high school. It was around that time where you do your Shakespeare's, and I have very clear remembrances of Romeo and Juliet and Othello. And I think it was 10th grade for Othello. But one of my teachers might actually come back and be like, no, baby, it was definitely 8th grade. So be kind to me. But it was in my high school that I was reading. It was w those two Shakespeare's, Othello and Romeo and Juliet.
And where was high school for you?
I was in Southridge, Massachusetts.
Is that your home?
So no, that is where I grew up. My home now is New York, but I mean that's where my heart beat. That's where in my head when I think of if somebody asks me where's my hometown, it's Southbridge, Massachusetts.
So that's where you grew up.
Yeah, that's where I had my that's where I became my all the stuff. So yeah.
And are both your parents Nigerian?
They are, and they are both still in Southridge, Massachusetts, in our big old house on top of a hill. Yeah.
Join Play On Premium to get merch like t-shirts, hoodies, and coffee mugs, ad-free episodes, and bonus content video featuring interviews with the actors, producers, playwrights, and directors who brought it all to life. Go to ncpodcasts.com and subscribe to Play On Premium to support the art and the artists.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
How did you find your way into theater and writing?
Circuitously, most definitely. I very prototypical Nigerian immigrant. I'm sure people have heard the sayings like, you're Nigerian, your parents gave you options. You're going to be a doctor, a lawyer, you know, maybe if they're feeling fancy, a journalist. And so I started out thinking I was going to be a lawyer, partly from a very deep push from my parents. And I went to Wellesley College, and then I had an incredible dean there who asked me what I did for joy, and I didn't know. I was most definitely on a singular track, and maybe, not maybe, deeply unhappy inside of it, even though I was good at it, political science. And so this dean was like, let's put you on a different kind of schedule. And so I started singing opera, which I loved, with Gail Fuller. And then I started taking some acting classes at Wellesley, and those acting classes, I was like, oh, I like how stories change the world just as much as maybe how politics and law could change the world. And I feel more myself when I'm inside theater and performance. And so then I went to ACT. To the chagrin of my parents, I went to ACT to study acting because that was what I was dabbling in, and Wellesley was a performance. I get out, it's the Great Recession, and I start writing to process the world, and I'm writing in the form I just studied in. So that's how playwriting started for me. And that's what I mean when I say circuitous. I did not There are some of my friends who knew that they were going to be writers when they grew up. They just knew it and were chasing it. That was not me. It was a stumbling into, and then once I understood it, wait, let me grab at it and go.
What does it mean to say you started writing in the form you studied in?
So I studied plays. I was at ACT acting. So conservatory life, what is it? I think it was fair to say 6 days a week, 13 hour days inside of play. And so I was reading plays voraciously because of the program, then acting inside of plays. And so when I get out of ACT, when I write, I was writing in play form. Because that's the mind I had been in. And I guess I you know, that's actually a great thing to pull out, because it's not as if writing is new. At Wellesley, I've always written poetry. I've always written short story. It's just that I'd never really written plays until I'm out of ACT. And then it was like, well, no, this is what I write. I write plays.
Had you, how far did you get in your pursuit of acting, and was it a conscious choice to change course?
So this really gets into there are two thrusts. First, it's the Great Recession. So if you're remembering that period, there was a pullback in the theater too. And so getting jobs was harder in general. And then also this was I'm an African kid. I'm an African girl. And so I was going out for the African parts and not African enough or for some of them, and that's the harsh reality was it wasn't I wasn't able to sit within the part well. And then if it were parts like this was the period, if you remember this time too, where like Dreamgirls was coming back and was everywhere. And so I mentioned I sing opera. I couldn't sing the parts that I am character-wise. I look the type of, I should be singing Christine. I cannot sing that song, listen. I cannot do it. Somebody else will do it better, and you should sit and you should watch them. You don't want me to do that. And so we were also not at that point in theater where we were seeing other bodies inside of roles and going, ah, that can be. I was a bit early for that swing. So it's like I couldn't do the parts that I looked right for. The parts that I was, the African parts, I wasn't because it was Lion King, it was Ruined that was out. I aesthetically I wasn't right for a certain parts. And then in The Lion King, it was like singing the hyenas, and I wasn't right for that either. I was like, everywhere I went, it was like, oh, you are wonderful, but you're not quite the right type. And so I started writing the right type. And I thought that maybe I would be putting myself into my work. And then I was like, oh, no, I'm not. I started writing. I'm in the middle of writing my own cycle, Nigerians in America over the span of 100 years. And
Amazing.
so that's what started me on the track.
Can you talk a little bit more about what it is that you are writing in this cycle? 100 years.
I started in 1978. It's nine plays. I started in 1978 when Nigerians are like that swing of Nigerians coming into the country after decolonization and after the first modern African war, the Biafran War. So I start there, and it's centered on a matriarch. Her name is Abasiyama, and it starts out with the Sojourner Dream. I mean, the first play is called Sojourners. And it's the dream was you come to this country, you are in married pairs, you go to school, you get your education, you have a baby who will be an American citizen, and then you go back and you rebuild your country. So it's a very different way of thinking on what an immigrant is than what I think if you turn on the news, they tell you immigrants are. These are people who love their homeland, love their country, are coming here to rebuild. And then coup after coup later in Nigeria, you got children, you're like, I can't bring them back to that. And you have to reform the dream. But these were not immigrants who wanted to stay inside this country. They loved their country and were going to go back. And so that's what Abasiyama, my matriarch, is coming with that idea of. And we watch as she ends up staying inside of this country, how she navigates her marriage, how she navigates children now who are more American than Nigerian, and it's just like combustion. And then how do you deal with the family overseas? that you really want to be together? I mean, it's very, very immigrant. Most of the family is over there. How do you keep the family line going? And I track her until death and her progeny, all with the one of the big questions on, like, how do you build inside a country you never intended to stay within? What does diasporic healing look like over the span of 100 years as Africans and Black Americans are coming into contact with each other? What does that maybe healing and the beginnings of a new dream centered inside that love relationship? And I do that from 1978, and I'll go into 2000. 70, which is great because I'm all, we're almost there. And I and so yeah, that's what I'm doing.
Do you know where it ha what happens? Have you gotten there
I
yet?
do. I've wrote the end. I ended up writing quite soon. I mean, I had to do matrices in order because this is an interconnected cycle. So I needed to have my edges done and then fill in the middle. So I do know where we are ending, and I do know how we get to 2070 without like busting future time in a great way. But yeah,
Without getting into futurism and sci-fi and all that.
exactly. There are some wonderful tricks which I'm not gonna give out right now because I don't want to blow my plays. But yes, there are ways in which I am firmly in the future, while not having to deal with what the technologies might be.
When you're writing, do you tend to, so you have a roadmap ahead of you generally, or is it different for every project you do? Do you map it out first, or do you kind of, I know some writers kind of put it all out there without any kind of map in mind. They just have a sense of some sort of a story, and they put out pages and pages and pages, and then whittle it down to where they want it to be.
I'm inside I think that I have fluidity, but I haven't been inside that kind of fluid space in a minute because I'm inside of a cycle. So the first three plays were written wide with real feel and scope. And then once I isolate, because I went one play, three plays, five plays, nine plays, and then called nine my end. Once I understood I was inside real long form interconnected storytelling, which is around play three for me, everything needed to be beat out within an inch of its life. I needed to know where I was going, which decades I was landing in, and kind of why. And I was writing backwards and forwards at the same time. So I needed it to be pretty concrete. There's another play that I'm writing now that's outside the cycle. And that play, I'm allowing myself to feel and just sort of ramble and rumble through. And it sounds so different than anything I've ever written. And so, yes, I think both are true of me, but because I'm inside of a cycle, I have more history of outlining real tight scaffolding, understanding the research, and doing a kind of writing math.
So you're able to work on multiple projects at the same time.
Yeah, like I translated Othello while inside a cycle and also writing for TV. It's a little crazy on the brain, but yeah, I do. I do juggle projects.
Does well, and clearly that works for you.
It does. It has been. But there is this period now, when this comes out, the strike will probably be over. And I'm talking about the writer's strike. That will be over. But in that period, I have been writing plays and been pretty one track. And my mind does like it. My mind does like being sunk in one thing at one time. But as most artists know, especially with the precariousness of our field, is sometimes you got to juggle in order to get the things that you need. And so I've had to juggle, but I do like this period where I was able to just lock in and go, what is a cycle play? And I think that that might be over by the end of this week. So I'll be back in multiple things again.
Is television writing restrictive for you?
It's so different. There's a different science, a different propulsion behind it. I don't know that I would call it restrictive. I think I'll say it like this. Writing four plays at the same time would be impossible for me. But writing a TV show, writing a play, and editing a movie are deeply possible. They're different parts of my brain, different pieces, different, slightly different logics for everything. And because of that, I can move between those mediums easier. So I wouldn't say that it's restrictive. I wouldn't say that it's creatively restrictive. I do think I do come into like real issues about their 24 hours in a day. And so if I'm inside of a writer's room, that might be 5 hours of my day gone if you're in a Zoom room. And then after that, what is a little downtime to rest yourself as a human to then turn in around into a play to then turn around into a film? So it's, if anything, it's the time restriction. I don't know if it's the creative restriction if I order my plate right.
Do you ever feel a calling to be an actor in any of your projects or in any other projects?
No, I used to. I used to think that I was writing in order to put myself in them. And then the deeper my writing got, the more I was like, no, this is not for me to do. What I like is to write parts that are delicious and complicated for people of the African diaspora to be with it. And I thought that it was going to be me, but I enjoy it's enough to write. And when I realized that, I did realize that while I like acting, I love writing, and that is those are two different storytelling vessels. So I love being inside the writing vessel. I love seeing a whole scope and designing a whole scope of a world. I actually like the chatter of all the voices in my brain. I get a little and it's not a lie, so I'm gonna say it like I say, I get a little cranky when I'm locked into one. And so I have a tendency to act in the in-between and really pick the project that makes my soul sing because I know that I'm gonna get cranky in the middle of the run. So it's just the knowledge of my being, and I do love actors. So it's like, you do it. I don't need to. I don't need to. So, yeah.
Were there ways in which working on Othello served you as a writer on your other projects?
It's always good to sit there and understand the meaning behind a word, the reason why. I mean, you can't talk about Shakespeare without talking about rhetoric. And it was a reminder for me. I don't know if we're even teaching rhetoric anymore in the way that I actually learned it. And this is my bed as a writer anyway. And so to be inside a project which made me go, well, is it red? Is it crimson? Am I going to destroy a line to get that word crimson? And why? And the all of this bandying I'm doing back and forth around a word and around a scan of a line reminded me of the beauty inside construction. And then when you're talking about like one of the rhetorical devices, repetition and like the picking of the word that you are beating somebody with. So it becomes part of their heartbeat and then starts making them a wholly different human being. It was a wonderful reminder of that. And so it's trickling into like inside comedies that I'm doing, you know, where I'm just like six times over the course of a play saying a word and then the delight in watching that skip into somebody else's mouth. Mm. Yeah, mm. It's just a remembrance.
Were there places where you felt like there wasn't an adequate way to put it, even though it's unintelligible to us today without mm-hmm. opening those books, those lexicons, the source material? Did you ever come up against that?
Oh, I wish I remembered the line. All I can tell you is yes. And that I think that the line is in there as it was in the Shakespeare.
So in the spirit of do no harm, where you felt like you couldn't put it any other way, it stayed the way it was.
Yeah, it stayed the way it was.
Such a difficult play to have to live with for what? How long?
Almost a year and a half.
Were there points in your process working on it where you just grew to dislike it?
Oh, yeah. And I grew to dislike it early because I didn't know what I chose. I had 10th grade brain on. I thought I chose a love story, a tragic one. I had actually kind of yin-yanged Romeo and Juliet because of high school going, okay, they're both tragic love stories. One the teenage version, one the adult version.
So you literally didn't know what you were getting into.
I literally didn't until I read it with my brain now. And read it without like somebody instructing me to think only on the love between Desdemona and Othello. And I went, what is this? This is horrible. I was like, I don't know that it should be called Othello. I think it should be called Iago, a way to marginalize. That was me, you know? So my distress began early because I had an incorrect thought on what this was in my head. And then as a kid in 10th grade, God help me, eighth grade, I don't know. In some grade, as a kid, I thought that Desdemona and Othello's relationship was just the most amazing thing. And like now as an adult, I'm like sitting and thinking about age. Mm. Desdemona's young, Othello's older. And then I'm sitting like for a half an hour or whatever, just staring off into middle distance going, okay, how much of this is my contemporary brain putting something on it and going, that's not okay? How much of this is not just not okay? Like, how do I translate that? Like, no, it became complicated fast.
Did you ever think you were not going to do it like that? You were going to call Louis Douthat at Play on Shakespeare and just say, you know what, I can't.
No, I didn't. I did call Louie though and go, I didn't know what this was. And she laughed. She's like, yeah, I wanted to put you on one of the comedies. I was like, bro, I should have gone. But at that point, I'm knee deep in. And I'm like, no, actually, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to translate it for what I think is being said. I'm going to do this so that you can hear what it is I'm now feeling now that I understand what those lines are.
It's so interesting to know that in your mind over time between working on this and having been introduced to it, that the love story was what you came away with, right? That's a convoluted way of saying it's interesting that is how you retain the story because that's the starting point. Right. There's this beautiful love between these two people that just seems absolutely untouchable, pure. Mm-hmm. I've been saying that I think it's the cruelest of all tragedies because that beautiful love is destroyed. But that is definitely it is definitely not a love story. It's a hate story.
It's a hate story. It's actually The protagonist is Iago, even though we call it Othello, the Moor of Venice, the person who is moving with clear arcing and enacting action in the way that I was taught, is Iago. Everyone else is reacting to the things that he is doing. So that is where my eye is. And he's not inside love relationship. He's inside of jealous rage and hatred. And so when I left school, I had this thought on, oh, he understood he was wrong and he killed himself and he's with Desdemona and it's okay. That's who I was as a kid. Not the thing. The thing is the man who was deciding to like detongue himself and not talk about the evil he's just enacted. That's the thing.
Right.
And the odiousness of not talking when all these people are laying bloody, dead.
Right.
From what you've done. Oh no. I didn't understand as a kid. I don't know that I had quite enough of the education around what this play was potentially doing. I think that, and also in our time period now, if you really got in there, there will be people who would ban the talking about what is happening inside of this play, but must be done because I left going, tragic love story. Gosh, I wish Othello and Desdemona like lived and got together and that was it without thinking any deeper about. I was, you know, I'm a kid reading this. So like, what do you want me to take from it? I took the love.
Well, and that is the big question that I'm left with is what do we take away from this story? To be cautious, to be on your guard, to trust no one? I mean, what is the lesson?
For me, the lesson is that we've been doing this from time immemorial. And if we don't actually look at what the root of what Iago is, we're all going to do. We manifested today, yesterday. And it doesn't have to be manifested in the future, but you have to deal with Iago. And like, that's the thing that we don't see is what is the dealing with Iago? And so what is next after Othello? Like I'm so interested in us writing as a society, what the elliptical after Othello's death is. Because we just keep doing this story over and over and over as an individual, as a society. We just keep manifesting it. What is happening to the thing that is now not speaking? I am interested in that. And if you are teaching Othello with that, towards that eye, I'm okay. Okay, if you are breaking down Iago and asking what should happen next, what do we do? As opposed to just keeping teaching Othello and like recreating, we continually do the Iago of it. No, it is such a thing that he never talks again. And it becomes this insidious thing that can just keep happening now without talking about it. It is now the thing we'll rotate and keep doing. What happens if we talk? Yeah, what happens next?
Unspooling the mind of Iago.
Yeah, and reckoning with what it wrought, what it manifests. And God help us, maybe potentially deciding to do something else. Maybe the play ends on silence from the most evil. And what now?
So we get to the end of this story. We're left with silence, questions, sorrow. We have to come together to move forward. We have to deal with that.
Yeah.
We can't just leave it there and ignore it and say, what a horrible story, and then go about our day.
No. We actually need to understand what the punishments are. We need to understand what the new world order will be.
Are we there right now, do you think, as a society?
We're trying to roll back.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to roll back. We're actually doing that thing of detonguing that happened to Iago.
Right.
In order, we're going to keep the...
With the banning of books and the...
All of that.
The anti-racism efforts.
The anti-woke, all of that stuff. We are squashing the tongue and maintaining, going, this is as it is.
We're just going to live with it. We're racist and ugly, and there's nothing to see here.
It doesn't have to be. It doesn't right. have. That's what's happening in another sector. And then, you know, there are those teachers who are like, I'm going to teach it the correct way. And God help me, I'm so scared, but I'm going to do it. You know, so we don't always shine light on the fact that there are people who are working, but like, in teaching the Othello, in teaching that piece, I hope that we are also going to have dynamic discussion on what it was, what happened, and now what. So I hope that we don't fall prey to that thing that's happening right now, that wing of us right now, that is like, let us just keep this quiet and keep it silent.
And Vanessa, it's been a great conversation. I'm so, so grateful that you were a part of it with us, and you've done just remarkable work on this tragic story, but you've given us a way to deal with it. And it's a great gift. I want to thank you for your time, your talent, and your courage to just dive in here and tell this story in a new way. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Play On bonus content series for Othello. You can learn more about the Play On podcast at Next Chapter Podcast website, ncpodcast.com. That's N as in next, C as in chapter, podcasts with an S at the end.com, where you can find other Play On podcast series and interviews, along with talk podcasts like The 500, The 10, Beef with Bridget Todd, and a whole lot more. I'd like to thank Jeremiah Tittle, the founder of Next Chapter Podcast, and my producer, Pete Musto. Our audio engineer, editor, and sound designer is Justin Cortez. Be sure to subscribe to Next Chapter Podcast for updates on all the latest content, and don't forget to rate and review our shows. It really does make a difference. I'm Michael Goodfriend, and I look forward to sharing more incredible works in the Play On Podcast series with you, along with lots of enlightening bonus content at Next Chapter Podcasts.
Next Chapter Podcasts.